You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges. And follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
We also have been asking our colleagues, citizens across Europe and Africa, through our online platform, our conversation online, which is called Debating Europe. And they have sent us quite a few comments, which I think you see there up on the screen. And I think some of their comments really go to the heart of the issues we're talking about today. You can read them, but let me just tell our panelists here as well. So, first one is, China does not have the baggage of colonialism in Africa and is therefore confidently expanding its investments there. Patrick says, people criticize China for not making investment conditional on democracy and good governance, but when did Europe or the United States ever do business that was conditional on these values, these things? China's no-strings-attached approach to investment gives African countries alternatives and may eventually isolate Western influence in the region. So these are some of the questions that I'd like you, Yentl and José, and our Chinese colleague when he comes. But let's start off with you, José, while we wait for our Chinese friend. A lot is said, as I said, about differences, values, approaches, human rights, not human rights. But does Europe really need to work with China in Africa? Is this something that you want to do, that you're doing? What are your aims when you try and do that?
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for your introduction and for the invitation to be here this afternoon. Do we need to work with China? Yes, I think so. I think in a global world we need to work with others. We are an actor that cannot do things in isolation. And it's very difficult to do anything in isolation in the current global world. We have an interest in working with China in the sense that there are objectives, there are targets that are actually quite similar between us and the Chinese. And we've been lobbying actively for this cooperation to become a reality. It's nothing new here. I mean, I think since 2003, at least, we were able, from a conceptual point of view, to determine that there was an interest to go for cooperation rather than for confrontation with China in Africa. It's clear, and I see some Chinese friends here in the audience, that their conception of time and our conception of time are not exactly the same. So we tend to have a policy and immediately wanted to see results of this policy. Otherwise, it's a problem for decision makers and when dealing with their constituencies. China has a different approach, and so they're more prudent, and this is ideas that they have to warm up. But also has to do with new realities that that the Chinese are absorbing from Africa. We could say that at the beginning, a kind of investment was a risky investment in China when there was practically no Chinese in the continent. Now it's a different thing. There's a lot of Chinese. People speak about 1-2 million Chinese that are probably living in Africa. There's a duty on the Chinese authorities to protect their citizens. And now, the word stability, which has always been very, very paramount in the Chinese speech, is becoming to have a meaning, a real meaning, in the sense that to do business, and this is one of the objectives of China in Africa, to do business, you need to have stability. Or stability for the Chinese is not far away from what we call as Europeans peace and security. In the sense that what we are trying to have here is an environment that will be conducive to create the jobs and to create the growth that you, Shada, were alluding at the beginning in your question. And I think that this understanding that the Chinese policy of no interference would not respond completely has nuanced a little bit the Chinese thinking. And we could see in the book that some of the Chinese scholars are precisely going into this direction. So what happens now is that Chinese people are dying in Africa when there are riots, when there are terrorist attacks. And so China has a duty to protect these people. And they understood that it's negative for business if countries are not stable. We saw it is very much in conflicts like in South Sudan, or even in Sudan, that Chinese policy was changing. So this gives us, I believe, a much more, much broader scope for going through the bilateral and trilateral cooperation that we're aiming for. We have council conclusions from December 2008, if I'm not mistaken, saying that we should work with China and Africa in order to have trilateral cooperation. I must say that at the beginning, Beijing was not particularly enthusiastic about this idea, I suppose more than anything else through a lack of communication about what we were doing. They were kind of surprised by this policy. Otherwise, the colleagues from the commission in the room that have always guaranteed me that they had been consulted. Maybe they consulted the wrong Chinese. In any case, the reaction, and I think what is important here, is that this kind of negative reaction has changed. And I noticed, because at the time I was accompanying the conversations we have with China on Africa that take place every year, and from a kind of almost hostility at the beginning in 2009, by 2011 they have really warmed up to the idea and were much more interested in discussing Africa with us. Now, the problem we have is to pass from theory to implementation. Yes, we have elected peace and security as the area where we can make progress faster, in the sense that we believe that since, as I said, our interests are common, or at least similar, we could work together. Some is already happening. It's the case with UNAVFOR in Somalia. And we're trying, and we can perhaps discuss this later in the session, we're trying to identify other areas where we can actually go further in terms of this cooperation. So the answer in a nutshell to your question, yes, we should do it, we need to do it, and we hope that China has the same degree of willingness as we have to implement this kind of cooperation in Africa.
So, José, a learning process, both sides trying to understand each other better, but a long process of getting to know each other on this area, in this area, which really, as Giles says in his foreword, really hasn't been explored by Europe and China in any great detail.
Well, it's a fair assessment, the first part, perhaps less on the second one, in the sense that we do have a lot of discussions with the Chinese about it, not only about Africa in particular, but also with the peace and security area. We have established a kind of a framework structure that has five different levels, according to the hierarchy, where we discuss the Chinese concrete ideas about how to increase what we're trying to build. And I remember that the Chinese have sometimes even very interesting proposals that they've done us. I remember this was not less than 2 years ago that when I was in Beijing, one of Major General from the Chinese People's Liberation Army was asking us, why don't we have common maneuvers in the Mediterranean with you? Which was a little bit out of the box. But that in itself also shows that there is a willingness from the Chinese to find out where these areas of cooperation can be increased. So, yes, I think that it's a learning process. I think that we need to understand that we, of course, have different channels, sometimes different practices, sometimes different ways of doing business and here business in on a more general way. But yet we have to build trust. Yeah, of course, we have to build trust, and sessions like this one, I believe, are very instrumental in precising building this kind of trust. But the potential is there. The potential is starting to be realized. Mm-hmm. Somalia was a good example. We're trying, for instance, in Mali also to see what can be done. There are things that were done together in Sudan and South Sudan that go beyond the peace and security to come into the political area.
Right.
And so this cooperation, I think, has the possibility, has legs to march on.
Okay, so while we wait for, let's say, the Chinese point of view on what you're saying, Yentl, I want to ask you, there's a point also that Giles made in the beginning. President-elect, we have to say it, Donald Trump, hasn't really articulated anything on Africa, right? And does that mean that Africa, which has had close ties with the Obama administration, there was an African strategy that President Obama had, does Europe now have a more dynamic profile, do you think, apart from the colonial baggage that our citizens refer to as well? Do you think there's an opportunity for us to have a brighter profile, a different profile, a fresher profile in Africa?
Thank you for that question, Shada, and thank you very much, Ravita, for inviting me here today. This is a really important debate, and as you framed it in the context of the results of the US presidential elections this morning, which we all have to engage with. On the EU, what can the EU learn from this, and how can we evolve? One of the questions we discussed beforehand was about African solutions to African problems, and I think this is the starting point. We need to, in many debates, in fact, on African development, the point is often raised, how important is it to have African solutions for African problems? And I think more now than ever, we need to wake up to the fact that everyone has issues in their own house. Americans have issue in their house. As Europeans, we have issue in the European Union. Yes, African solutions can work for African problems, and in this regard, the priority should be the African Union 2063 vision, and all other actions should be complementary to that. Second to that is, I think, disaggregating what we mean by Africa, and I think it's a very easy and simple point to say Africa is not a country. And all too often we talk about Africa, but we don't actually know what we're talking about or have any regard to the specific details. I'm not sure if you remember a map on the front page of The Economist in 2014, a beautiful map, in fact, and I love this image. It shows how large Africa is, because inside of the continent of Africa, you can put the EU, US, India, China, and Japan. So when we talk about Africa, we're talking about a lot of things at the same time. And then also, when we talk about Africa in the EU context, often we're not talking about the African continent as a whole. We're talking about sub-Saharan Africa. We could be talking about the ACP group. So there are many things. And I think going forward, these are two things to bear in mind. Yes, African solution for African problems, bearing in mind we live in an inclusive world of partnership, et cetera, et cetera. We depend on foreign direct investment, et cetera, et cetera. And secondary to that, Africa is large. Let's be precise about what we're talking about.
So, Sayantal, you have worked extensively on trade issues. Now, trade is a very important component of Europe-Africa relations. When you look at what we're doing in terms of trade, do you see possibilities for improving this, changing the partnership, the EPAs? I mean, they are very controversial still. What are your views on this?
With regard to the EPA,
so economic partnership agreements, these are these trade agreements that the EU is negotiating with ACP countries. Yeah.
Yes, the EPAs are the new generation of free trade agreements. So it moves beyond a reciprocal relationship with the ACP countries, one based on asymmetry and preferences to one based on free trade. And these have been, as you mentioned, very controversial. Many of them are still under negotiations or negotiations have stopped. They are interim agreements. And these are meant to be regional development agreements between the EU and regions of the African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries. And often some of these agreements don't respect African regional boundaries as they already exist. And I think this is one of the issues with the EPAs going forward. It's the difference of Africa's own vision for its own development and then the EU vision that is superimposed via trade. And going forward with the EPAs, now we've seen the conclusion of the SADC EPA and EAC with just a few of the members. We have the full ECOWAS text online, and the CARIFORM EPA has been concluded since 2007. We nevertheless have a situation whereby we need to analyse these agreements in depth, understand how they will work going forward, and there needs to be a lot of work specifically on the trade security nexus. And if I can make a recommendation, I'd really love that the next edition is on the trade security nexus, because I think it's fine to talk about security, but security and trade are highly linked. And for me personally, as a trade expert, we can't talk about trade or we can't talk about security without linking it to trade. When you secure access to markets, it's you usually do so with a stable region.
Thank you very much. Our Chinese colleague is still not here, but there are many Chinese friends in the audience here, so I'm very, very happy to take questions and comments from yourselves. I'd like to open the floor now because I see a wealth of expertise here in the room. I can keep asking questions, but I'd really like you to do the same thing now. So please, do come forward, ask your questions. We've got two panelists, and this can be a very interactive discussion. So I'm happy to take the first question. You just have to identify yourself, and we have a microphone that will come to you. So I already have Pauline, my colleague at Friends of Europe. Bo? Yes?
Thank you very much. Yes, indeed. I work alongside Shada at Friends of Europe on our peace, security, and defense program. And my question is, one of the reactions to Trump's election in the US is likely to be a resurgent Japan in terms of security, which will only exacerbate tensions in Asia and likely increase the arms race. Is that likely to impact EU-China relations in Africa? So I'd actually like to ask that of all three panelists.
Okay. Welcome, Jimin. Thank you, Noel. We understand the impediments you had. Right. But we've already had our introductory statements, but I know that you wanted to say a few words. You had prepared something on a topic that is of interest to you. So let's hear Jimin now, and then we'll come back to the questions. So I'll give you time to take out your notes. Sorry, this is very kind of you to jump in like this. Please, go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much, and apologize once again for being late and due to the traffic jam. And I have two papers, but I'm not going to read.
No, don't read. So the debate has actually been, so very, very simply, that you know we've said that this is a time with what's happened overnight, the election in the US, etc. This is a time that Europe and China can actually, you know, forget about all the rivalries and competition we've talked about in the past, but actually work together for the development of a continent that is very essential for world peace and security. Your comments.
Okay, and as I'm trying this morning, trying very hard to shift my mind from the situation across the Atlantic and come back to the continent of Africa. And although I have just prepared something and trying to maybe to let you know something that maybe you have already be familiar with and maybe something that you're not. But concerning the China-EU cooperation in the African continent, actually, I think maybe it's better to put it China-EU-Africa cooperation. That's trilateral cooperation in that continent. And for your pattern, maybe it will be a little bit more helpful to take a few minutes, allow me to express some our concept, explain our concept concerning the our efforts to contributing to the peace and the stability and the security in Africa. And we have four quite long-hold and quite important principles. First is that we advocate non-interference in national affairs of African countries and abiding by those basic norms of international relations, which I take note that in the final text of the report that some contributors made some argument about China's long-hold position of non-interference, which maybe I believe will be discussed in later stage. But it's our position, and I would also be very pleased to discuss with friends, and which on this basis we will constructively participate in the settlement of the hotspot issues and according to the needs and wishes of the countries concerned. That's the first principle. Second principle is that we support African people to solve African problems in an African way, because we certainly believe that African people know the best about the real situation and should be in the best position to solve their own problems. Thereby, we support countries concerned, Africa sub-regional organizations, and the African Union to play their due role in solving regional hotspot issues. Third is that we advocate settling disputes by peaceful means. We support talks and negotiations and seeking mediation and settlement under the framework of the UN and other regional organizations. As last resort, military actions should be under the authorization of the UN and with permission of countries concerned. Fourthly, we propose comprehensive management. Hotspot issues in Africa oftentimes were interwoven with complicated national, religious, and social conflicts, and therefore we should tackle their symptoms and the root causes at the same time, not only paying attention to meeting the current challenges, but also making efforts to uproot the causes. So I think it will be fair to say Africa deserves great international support in its development, and therefore China welcomes more diversity in Africa's partnerships and stand ready to work with other partners in international community to support Africa under the principle of raised by Africa, agreed by Africa, and led by Africa. Respecting Africa's centrality is essential for such cooperation. With this said, I would like to make clear that China is open to work with EU, just like we do with the United States, Russia, and other countries, to promote peace and stability in Africa. In fact, there was already consensus in the China-EU summit joint statement in June last year, which notes both sides will take to enhance cooperation in new areas of common interests, including the support for peace and security in Africa. And actually, there was already some work done. So we also believe it's a part of China-EU cooperation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jumin. Thank you very much indeed. You said yourself in the beginning, non-interference is an issue that we can talk about. So I do want to talk about it, because the general impression we have is, yes, in principle, you are still sticking to that idea. But the reality on the ground is different, because the reality on the ground means that you are changing your approaches to certain governments, certain organizations. So is there not a disconnect between the reality on the ground and your principle of non-interference and not non-endurance in affairs?
Yes. I think the main problem, the main crux is that actually maybe there are some kind of difference of understanding about the principle of non-interference. In the traditional or traditional Western diplomatic theory, that non-interference maybe means indifference. But according to our opinion, that non-interference does not mean indifference. Therefore, actually, maybe 30 years ago, when China is not that developed as today, we still have very, very close contact and a very, very close cooperation with African countries. And we also contribute to the construction of infrastructure, social stability, and the health systems to African countries. When we are saying that the principle of non-interference, that I think according to our philosophy is that we first means we respect the local countries. We put our friends at the same, totally the same ground, the same footing. And that's the first point. Second is that concerning the principle of non-interference, it does not necessarily mean we always want to impose or forcing our model of development to our friends. And we certainly have quite good communications with our African friends. We always call them our African brothers, which has been called for almost 50 years. Maybe we can talk in the later in this regard. But we always just treat them as equals and good friends. And that's the third point for us concerning non-interference is that we always respect the local people, local country, local organizations, and we have very good cooperation with AU and the when we are doing cooperation through bilateral or multilateral channels, we always, just as I said, mentioned, that it's proposed by Africa or raised by Africa, agreed by Africa, and led by Africa. I think that's a kind of maybe Chinese contribution to the philosophy of non-interference.
Thank you very much. You. Whatever China has done, I have to say it has raised Africa's profile on the global stage. I mean, I think it would be fair to say, José, that for a long time, we were rather complacent about Africa. We had policies, we had strategies, but we were not thinking strategically. And I think what China's work in Africa has done is to bring it higher up the global agenda. I think most of us will agree on that. So thank you for that. Let's go back to the questions. So yes, Yentl, definitely, do come in. Yes.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond there. And I think this is what's so interesting about triangular cooperation going forward, is that, in fact, the partners can leverage what they're good at. Mm-hmm. And when I was in Addis Ababa in January of this year for the Heads of State Summit, a friend showed me around the African Union headquarters, and I was stunned. And they said, oh, it's a gift from the Chinese. And it's very interesting because it will also be maintained by the Chinese. And I thought, wow, I study the EPAs, and they've been controversial since its inception. And actually, the Chinese, you have a very different model compared to the EU. And I think going forward, they're can be a lot of learning between both parties on what the EU has in terms of comparative advantage, in terms of history and the legacy it needs to really overcome beyond 2020, beyond 2030, and up until 2063 and beyond, and also the Chinese competitive advantage that is shining right now in Africa and evident from any visit, especially to Addis.
José, do you want to respond to this?
Not respond, but just comment. In the sense that reducing European contributions to Africa to EPAs is perhaps a little bit too short. On our current financial cycle, we are, the EU and its member states, are contributing with something like more than 30 billion euros to Africa. AMISOM in Somalia cost us 200 million, to the European taxpayer, 200 million euros a year. So EPAs are something, in our view, could be a huge opportunity for Africa, continental and even sub-regional objectives to become a reality. They give an opportunity, and it will depend how much Africa would like to take advantage of this opportunity. Indeed, it might be painful. Some of the reforms that are needed to be done over there might be painful. But if they are not done, the results would be worse. This was a negotiation that took a long time, like most trade negotiations always do. There was a particular concern in trying for the EPAs to be asymmetric, in the sense that African products are still protected in an open market, while Europeans are not. So, indeed, it is still, as you said, it needs to be discussed perhaps more thoroughly in terms of what will be the impact of EPAs, but we remain convinced that this will be positive for Africa.
Right. Because Yentl's, if I may just interrupt, Yentl's point was really that, you know, we each have assets and competences that we should leverage. So I think we're not just talking about trade. But let's move on, and you'll have plenty of time to come back. So I have Graham Watson, I have Giles coming in, I have a lot of hands, Eberhard, I have yourself as well. So Graham, perhaps for you first. Just put up your hand, please. Bo, it's here.
Thank you. Graham Watson, European Economic and Social Committee. One of the areas of cooperation that is very much to do with security, but which is perhaps not thought of, is cooperation in climate and in energy policy. It's an area where, sadly, the Americans have not been terribly engaged and are perhaps less likely to be now. But I know that the National State Grid Power Corporation of China is doing a lot of thinking and work on this, along with the Chinese Renewable Energy Industries Association. Is there an opportunity, perhaps even in these 2 weeks in Marrakesh at the COP, for the Chinese and the Europeans to work together on the development of Africa using their abundant opportunities for renewable energy so that we are not going to add to the climate problems that we're facing and the problems that we've seen of development in Europe and China thus far.
Thank you very much for that, Graham. So the gentleman here in the front row, please.
Thank you so much. I'm Mutraf Siddiq, Ambassador of Sudan. And I'm glad to be invited for this important topic, which actually were the subjects of the matter. I thought that I could find many of our African colleagues in this session, but it seems that many had not received maybe the invitation of the client to come.
We did send invitations.
Yes, sure, I know, because I have received one. Yeah. So I thank you for that, and I think the issue is very important, and it can't be discussed in absence of Africans, at least on the this side. I think that next time when we discuss these issues, we have to involve our colleagues, especially we are having an organization now, the African Union, which is having an institute for dealing with the issue of security. And they had been here just last week discussing with the European Union the issue of the security in Africa that concerns the European Union. The issue is very important, and I believe that security is a cross-cutting issue and a prerequisite for many things to happen. But as I had been said by my sister here and my colleague from Chinese embassy, it has to be supportive to the African institutions to take the prime responsibility and to develop solutions, because external operations are very expensive. One operation might cost billions of dollars annually. If we enabled our African fellows to do that job, it will be cost-effective. And also we train our brothers in Africa to take the responsibility and to resolve their problems their own way. We don't call at all for disregarding the issue of human rights or the other rights to be respected. But it has to be in a way that we shouldn't feel that we are intervening in the internal affairs. We are supporting because it is security is indivisible. If it is there is chaos in Africa, Asia or the vicinity, especially Europe, will suffer from that one. So I believe that we have to enable our institutions to deliver that one. Secondly, we have to start this cooperation with agreed areas. We have the SDGs. We have the issue of climate change. We have many issues, the issue of migration, for example.
Ambassador, may I ask you to just be slightly shorter, briefer?
Sure. Sorry, I will explain that.
But you talked, thank you very much. And indeed, we did reach out to many African ambassadors to join us on the panel. Sorry, we didn't. Eberhard here, and yes, the gentleman there at the back. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, my question is simple.
Just identify yourself very quickly.
Yeah, I'm Pei Ran Wang from the VUB. My question is, in the past 10 years, China's role in the international arms transfer is much more significant than ever. And what's the perception of, what's the African perception of China's international arms transfer to Africa?
What's
the European perceptions on such arms transfer to Africa? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Eberhard here. Yes,
please. Eberhard Wright, Friends of Europe. I very much appreciate this event. It shows me that we definitely have to organize many more of these, more specific to specific issues. And I have another question that has nothing to do directly with China-European cooperation. To our Chinese brother here, I would like to ask him to tell us a little bit what is part of the large-scale acquisition of African land in your Chinese policy.
Thank you very much for that. Eberhard, I just wanted to say to you, I was looking at that issue of, you mean agricultural land, right? Do you know how much the Netherlands has in Africa in terms of acquisition? It's a very interesting thing. It's not just China. There are so many European countries that have acquired land for agricultural purposes in Africa. It's really quite stunning and eye-opening. Let me just take one more question and then turn to the panelists. So, yes, please. Giles here, yeah.
Thank you very much, Shana. Yentl's reference to the security trade nexus made me think of why Xiumin Zhang was held up. You were held up by a demonstration of European steelworkers worried, calling for protection from Chinese steel products. And in a post-Trump world, or in a Trump world, we can expect protectionism to be a very live and dangerous problem. So my question is this. In Africa, do the panel think the present cooperation mechanisms will be adequate for defusing the economic tensions between China and the EU, who have a shared interest in security, but clearly are going to have divergent interests in terms of trade?
Thank you. I'm going to go to the back to the panel and then take another round of questions. So please hold your fire. So, José, can we start with you? But I would ask the panelists to be quite brief as well in the responses.
Well, the first question was about possible... As a result... No, the first one was the result of the elections in Africa possibly would make stronger tensions in Japan, and then this might have an effect on China. Well, it's a lot of ifs. on Africa, rather. Not on China, on Africa. Look, I think we have to take into consideration that the fact that we have common interests in a part of the world might not be the same everywhere. What we're talking here is where can we, in some cases, build bridges? That does not mean that we have to agree on everything. To give an example, we talk about the West. By West, we say Western Europe and the United States. We would never dream to do a démarche on the death penalty with the Americans, for instance, or on the ICC with the Americans, because even if we agree on a lot of things, there's a lot of things where we are far away from them. So if Japan and China become more belligerent, which is a huge if, let's see if it happens or not, hopefully not, would this have an effect on Africa? Well, there will be certainly competition between Japan and China. There already exists this competition, and I will not go to deal into that, perhaps for our Chinese colleague to answer. But I don't think this would affect the fact that we could still relate ourselves both with Japan and China in Africa, because we can. Perhaps there are things that are of common interest for all of us, like good governance, for instance. There are things where certainly there are differences of approach. On the climate change issue, yes, by all means. I suppose this was already the case on COP21 in what concerns climate change. I think there is a commonality of points of view on this issue. On energy, there's a lot of things that we are doing. There's a lot of things that China are doing. And I must confess that there's not been much of a dialogue between our programs and the Chinese programs. And there certainly is an area where we can improve and to see to which extent our projects are can coexist. Mm-hmm. A point about, of course, Africa is important. Of course, African ownership for us is a fundamental issue in terms of our cooperation with Africa. In the debate, we cannot touch on everything, but I think the systemic support that we have been given to the African peace and security architecture demonstrates my point. We want Africa to be able to solve its own security problems. Now, is APSA already totally operational, really operational? That is the question that we have to ask. To which extent Africa could, at this stage, be able to solve these problems, or does Africa need international cooperation to still resolve some of the security issues? So far, I think it does. In the future, we hope it won't, because that would really allow for African solutions for African problems. And certainly, Agenda 2063 is, for us, a reference that is important that we should follow. So as much as our Chinese colleague, I can say exactly the same words he said about Africa being the ones that decides. I mean, trilateral cooperation will only be possible if Africa is interested in this trilateral cooperation. Otherwise, we can't do it, and we won't try to force any model on it.
I think, let's turn to Yentl and then to Zhumin. Yes.
Thank you. I'll respond to the question on whether the present cooperation is adequate. And I thought perhaps, the Ambassador, you can respond to the question on arms transfer to Africa. So it's clear that present cooperation is not adequate. And although, José, you mentioned what the European taxpayer pays on security in Africa, I think we should also sort of switch the focus to what is lost. And I'm talking about illicit financial flows. We all know that Africa loses $50 billion in illicit financial flows a year. And then what about other things such as remittances? In 2015, the remittance flow was it $432 billion? That's three times what Africa receives in overseas development assistance. So I think we need to also innovate how we think in these concepts and look at actual the real flows and the quantities that we're talking about here. And for example, with remittances, transfer fees are actually really high, but why don't we look at how remittances can foster development, how remittances can foster security?
And that actually is one of the issues that is very high on our agenda, the Development Policy Forum, that we talk about new ways of financing. And Klaus Rudishoven knows very much a lot about what we're talking about. Zhumin, let me turn to you for some of them, especially about the arms transfers.
Okay. I would rather start from the first question of renewable energy, because due to my past working experience, if I'm not in Brussels this year, I will be in Marrakesh, because I used to be the director for the climate change office in our ministry, in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So I have the honor to take part in the negotiation of Paris Agreement and other important climate change negotiations. I totally agree with you that actually we could have a lot of things to do, a lot of cooperation and in this field in Africa. And actually China and the EU are already good partner and good working partner in the, not only in climate change negotiation, but also in the development of renewable energy. And maybe one thing that some friends are not aware, that actually there are totally unimaginable development, and the speed is really also out of expectation, and the cost of the solar electricity as well as the wind electricity is decreasing very fast. And I personally is quite being a climate change activist, and I'm quite optimistic that it will soon, the cost will even decrease further. And just as you correctly mentioned that in Africa, there exist such two good conditions. It needs the energy. Second, it have very favorable condition. It's very good natural condition. So why not let's working together with EU and do some pilot projects in Africa. So I very much look forward to the future cooperation in this field. And as concerning the arms sale or arms control, maybe I could personally just introduce to you some principles of Chinese arms sales, not only to Africa, but also to the other regions of the world. It's our national policy, so I think it's the same. Third is that we should always remain transparent, and the purpose of this arms sale is just to improve the defense capability of the receiving countries. That's the first point. Second point is that the arms sale should not be used to increase the instability of local or regional peace and stability. Third is that non-interference. With these three principles in practice, and we have some detailed regulation, for example, that it's banned in China that arms are sold to non-state or non-governmental entities. We only sell arms to those governments. And that when the governments are receiving these arms from China, they must provide those documents, necessary documents, and the documents explaining the purpose. Actually, we have in China, we do have very strict regulations in this field. That's the second.
I think we can move on with some more questions.
Yes.
And
okay.
We can come back to it. So I have four hands going up here. Start off with the gentleman here, my old friend there, gentleman there, Zhu Feng, yourself. Okay, so please.
Very brief. Paul Frisvold, Gilman Keith. In 2010, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee awarded the Nobel Peace Prize to Liu Xiaobo, hurting the feelings of the Chinese government and its people. Since then, Beijing has shown a cold shoulder to Oslo. This incident can happen to other EU countries. May I ask you from the EEAS, is there a human rights dimension in the EU strategy towards China?
Thank you very much for that. Please, lady at the back.
Hi, I'm Valerie Derizanie, president of Global Water Institute. Most of the time, I do not know how to speak if I do not use a case in point. I just came from Burundi where I saw the elections. Where I saw the crisis backing the elections. And I saw the EU stepping out, disagreeing with the Burundian government, and where China stepped in, meaning China, Russia, Turkey. So my question is, what kind of cooperation strategy is it possible between EU, China, and Africa, when we know when EU stepped out, China stepped in. And I've seen this case by myself. I saw at a different level, at high-ranking area where people go to have fun, China people will always step out and have fun among themselves. When we see EU people in Africa merging and doing things together. The only thing I know, as I said, this is a case in point, they are always happy to dialogue with the government, with the first and second level of government people, but not with other people, meaning only when they are doing business, they discuss with people.
Right.
Otherwise, they isolate themselves from other people.
Okay.
So what kind of cooperative strategy is it possible between the three levels? I mean, Europe, China, and Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I can't see the other hand. Yes, the gentleman over there, please. Thank you.
Hello. Yeah. Ribeiro from Vox Africa TV. So China in Africa, they used to say that it's a win-win cooperation. But in fact, now how they have already tasted the cake, they know very well that they need security. And the only part of the world who here invests in security in Africa is European Union. So why European Union don't invest more in security in order to mobilize the private sector from Europe to invest in Africa in order to become a real win-win-win strategy? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Fu Jing, I come to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Shada. I will go a little bit beyond the security.
Introduce yourself very, very
briefly. Yeah, I'm Fu Jing from China Daily. I want to ask my question first. But my question is going beyond the security, this kind of issue. Because I found that so far China, Europe, and Africa have a common baby. That is AIIB, you know, because you know, AIIB, Asia Investment Infrastructure Investment Bank, is not a China bank. It's not an Asia bank. You know, it's a common baby of you know, many countries in this world, and also particularly those countries from Africa, Europe, and Asia. So, how to take a good use of this, you know, new institutions to you know, benefit you know, African development. So, as I want to ask questions to the you know, to the, I ask the panelists to respond. And if Shada, if you allow me, I want to share some of my points.
Very briefly.
Very briefly. I have 3 points. First one, please visit Africa. That's my suggestion because, you know, if we want to discuss this topic, we need to, you know, have a first-hand experience.
Right. Second point, we Fujing really need to move quickly.
Yeah. And the second one is that we need to broaden this kind of topic. It's not only about the secure century. We need to discuss in the context of prosperity. You know, we should you know, discuss this kind of economic and social goal. And also, it's about growing development. And my third point is that we need to get the United States involved. If we put the United States, Europe, and China, and with together to develop, you know, Africa continent, that should be, you know, more efficient, more,
right,
you know, useful. And this morning, when I was listening to Trump's speech...
I'm so sorry. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, my quickly. Final point. You know, and it's quite encouraging that Trump has said that your American economy should be doubled during his term. So that should be a very encouraging message.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Fujing. Some optimism there, so that's good. Please, the gentleman right here, Bo, could you... And then that'll be, and then I'll turn to the panelists because we're overshooting our time deadlines.
Thank you. Thank you for the last question here. Ulrich Schmidt, I'm one of the lucky ones to have a piece in the report. So 1.5 questions. We hear a lot about African solutions for African problems. I totally agree. But there is a but, which is... how do we strike the balance between creating sustainable impact through African institutions and also gaining sustainable financial flows from European institutions and European citizens who want that to contribute to European interests? I'd like to hear the panel's opinions about how we can strike the balance. Second, my own argument, also in the report, is that we fuse maritime security, development and business into one perspective, which we can apply to different places where this makes sense. That means building more resilient communities in Africa around, for instance, European or Chinese interests, which then provides jobs and a better future for Africans. So a win-win-win, just like the gentleman over here. I would like to hear your opinions about that too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And also thank you for your contribution to the publication. Yenta, let's kick off with you.
Thank you. I'll respond to your question and also the question on structures. Both questions point to something that we're also facing with the future of EU-ACP relations. And what it is what's going to happen going forward. Just like the African Union, the ACP is heavily financed by the EU. This is something that needs to evolve beyond 2020, and it's the same thing at the African Union level. Many posts and departments are financed by the EU or other international donors. In order to have ownership of policies and ownership of our own futures, we need to own our institutions, be it here in the EU or be it at the African Union level. And one of the things on triangular cooperation going forward, I really wonder what it means in practice. And by this, I mean, if triangular cooperation is to intensify, then could we imagine an EU-China-Africa forum? Or at the parliamentary level, would there be an EU-China-Africa joint parliamentary assembly as it exists in the ACP context today? So I think many of these concrete questions are also there about how the partnership and cooperation in a triangular sense will actually
make sense in reality, how it will materialize.
Okay. José?
Well, first and foremost, let me make a comment on the illicit flows. It's not just an European problem, and I'm sure the same people I was talking about, the ones that have paid the taxes, are not the ones you're mentioning. And the question on human rights, for the gentleman that is looking at his iPhone. Hello? You asked me a question, didn't you? The answer is yes. Because the short answer, the longer answer is that we've been discussing human rights with China for quite a long time. I remember being presiding a session discussing human rights with China for 12 consecutive hours. It was very interesting. And is, of course, it's still part of our strategy concerning China. You investing more on security, that's a very interesting point, to which we have to stop somewhere, because there's a problem of absorption capacity. It's not just bringing money, it's the capacity of the institutions to whom we are supporting, they're being able to respond. And if we do not create this sustainability within those institutions, there will never be African ownership, which we said before, it's our objective. So, and what you just said about also about the fact that these organizations, African countries, have to put more support to their own regional organizations, to the African Union in particular, because otherwise, you be always depending on the willpower or the willingness of the of external contributors. The balance between sustainable impact and financial flows. Yeah, that is probably something that will take us a long time to discuss. It's of course a very very difficult balance. I think we have here a problem of communication in the sense that we'll never be able to communicate to our own audiences here in Europe what is the interest of contributing to peace and security and other areas in Africa, that we're actually trying to build something that will be important also for the European citizen. And so what you are proposing is in theory feasible. In reality, it's complicated. It also depends on African own willingness to go through that path. If they are, and if China also is interested in such a thing, yes, it would be good, because it would give much stronger evidence about what has been done, about the results of what we're trying to do. And if we could create those polls, it will have certainly a very beneficial effect. But it's not easy. It will take time for this even to mature into people's minds before we can actually get there. And I think was the question for...
There was one interesting question given today's environment from Fu Jing about involving the United States in all of this conversation.
If I was answering yesterday, I would say yes. Answering today, I say I don't know. Honestly, we'll have to wait and see what will be the foreign policy of the new administration, what will be the role of Africa in the U.S. foreign policy, what will be the willingness of the United States to keep cooperating both with China and the European Union. If the new administration knows what is the European Union, we hope so.
Definitely knows NATO. Thank you.
Okay. I would also maybe just quick response to some two or three questions. First, concerning that lady about China-EU relations or positions change in African continent. Actually, I think maybe there should be some kind of clarification that the relationship between China and the EU in African continent is not a kind of replacement, but there's not a problem of that when EU getting out, China coming, or when China getting out, EU coming. Why not we just work together with African people, with African community, in African continent? I think that could and should be the principle of our work in future days. Second is concerning the human rights. I don't know, the gentleman, what's your point? I would also to share with you some of my point is that I also work in human rights field for a few years. I also participated in the negotiation of the establishment of Human Rights Council. And when the gentleman, the name of the gentleman Liu Xiaobo, you mentioned, I was also aware of the process. But I would share with you that concerning the human rights issue, when we are mentioning about, or when we are talking about the human rights issue with our African friends, maybe we should bear some principles in our mind. First is that we never use human rights as a kind of tool to get uphand or to put either EU or somebody else in a kind of higher moral standard that we are better and we are wiser, we have more wisdom, you are lower. No. Everybody, every country are equal. And that's my first point. And second is that when we are talking about human rights, we never have the concept of or have an intention or notion of double standard. Human rights is universal. And there's no standard for Europe, there's no standard, no separate standard for China. Although certainly we have different national situations in different countries, but there should be a kind of universal standard, no double standard. Third is my suggestion is that when you are talking about human rights issues, for example, in a seminar concerning China-EU-Africa relationship, maybe you should also thinking about that those refugees drowned in Mediterranean from Africans, also please do get some more consideration and more sympathy to them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We could go on with this conversation for a very, very long time, and I think we at Friends of Europe definitely will, within our Development Policy Forum, but also in our Asia program, our China Forum. I just want to come back to what I said in the beginning. You know, I've been following the African story for a very, very long time as a journalist, including for the BBC African Service. Of course, I've been following China for a very long time as a journalist for the Far Eastern Economic Review, and of course, I'm an accidental European. Europe is part of my life and my passion. What has always struck me over the years has been this rivalry and competition between the powers when it comes to Africa. It's not just Europe and China. It's also Japan and India and the United States, Latin America. Brazil is a big player in Africa as well. But you know, times have changed. These are very troubled times. I can't tell you how devastated I am by what's happened. Not just Brexit. That was a shock. It was a bad shock. But what's happened now, it really, I think, goes to the heart of our future. And in these troubled times, I think it's time for a new conversation, a new paradigm, a new narrative. And I think we at Friends of Europe, for sure, are going to work on working together for a better world, a better future. So once again, I'd like to say new thinking on a secure century. And if I may say so, that I think should be really our motto, our slogan, as we go forward in a very, very difficult moment. So please join me in, first of all, praying for that, and secondly, to thank our panelists for their interventions, and also to all of you for your questions and your comments. They've been very useful. We're going to continue our conversation. Thank you.